Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX. It's made possible through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. My guest today is Katie Butler, a science journalist who's written about medicine's changing approach to the end of life. She's written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, Best Buddhist Writing, Best American Essays, and Best American Science Writing. Her first book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death, was an investigative memoir, an account of caring for her aging parents, and a critical analysis of how modern medicine has become focused on warding off death at all costs rather than preparing us for a peaceful one. It was named one of the year's 10 best memoirs and notable book of the year. Her new book, The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life, was released in early 2019 and will be the focus of today's discussion. You too can join our conversation by adding your comments and questions. You can call us at 805-781-3875. Again, that's 805-781-3875. Hi, Katie. Welcome.
Hi. It's nice to be here, Chris. Thank you.
You know, I've really enjoyed both of your books, and I'm really excited you're here today to talk about them. For those that don't know how or haven't had a chance to read your books, how is it that you came about writing both the first and then the second one?
Well, I was a freelance writer in California when my dad on the East Coast had a major stroke, and this transformed my life and my mother's as well as his, and I became a very involved caregiver with them for 7 or 8 years. The result of it was an enormous questioning of the role that medicine played in the last years of my father's life, how often it made things worse rather than better. So I ended up writing a first book, which was Knocking on Heaven's Door, and that was both a memoir of being a caregiver and also a critique of modern medicine and its failures in helping us have peaceful, humane, meaningful deaths. And that book was a big success, but then I turned 70 myself, and I realized that I was going to be facing all of the same pitfalls and passages that my parents had faced, and I realized that I needed, and I felt that my whole generation needed, a much better map so that we could avoid some of the worst of what we've seen happen with our parents, and also, more affirmatively, actually fulfill some kind of a vision of what a really good death could look like for us. So that's how I came to write the second book. Really, in a way, the first book was a very good description of a problem.
Yeah.
And the second book is much more organized towards, okay, we have a broken medical system. Mm-hmm. We're all afraid of dying. What can we do with these realities so that we can make things as good as possible for not just ourselves, but the people that we love?
Yeah.
So that's how it came to be.
Yeah, and in the second book, you know, even though it's called, you'd in the title are addressing the art of dying, it actually is really an art of living.
I agree. I mean, I think that became more clear to me as I was writing mm-hmm. it, that the art of living well actually segues very nicely mm-hmm. into the art of dying well.
Yeah.
And you know, we talk a lot about quality of life around the end of life.
Right.
But what I realized writing it is, if you don't figure out what a high quality of life is for you now when you're relatively healthy,
yeah,
and you can really examine these questions of, like, what gives my life meaning and joy and comfort, and how do I stay on that path as long as I possibly can? You know, if you don't address those questions when you've got, like, lots of energy and lots of mental mind space for, you know, approaching these things,
yeah,
it's unlikely you're going to be able to figure it out at the last minute in a crash course on dying.
Well, I thought the other thing that I found in your book too is that it also comes to terms with aging. There is this you talk about the fear of dying. I think there's also a real morbid fear of aging that we're all facing.
And I think, you know, it's not all our fault. Our culture plays such a huge part in it. We see, you know, AARP stories about, like, 80-year-old marathon runners.
Right.
And we have so much shame in this entire culture about any kind of disability or imperfection.
Yeah.
And that can get just so magnified toward the end of life. And, I mean, just sort of really simple things like, I think it's much better when you're aging to look good rather than to try to look young.
Yeah.
And I would much rather, like, go around in sneakers and therefore hike a lot more than try to totter around in high heels as an older person and actually make my overall health really
worse.
A lot worse. So I think, you know, got to choose sanity over vanity at this stage of life.
Yeah, I love that expression in your book, was the sanity over vanity. You talk about in your book, you describe different stages of aging. Would you mind going through some of those stages?
Not at all. So one of the things I felt in this book is that we need a roadmap for this uncharted territory, which is the nature, the true nature of decline, aging, approaching disabilities or minor or major disabilities. We need a roadmap because if we know where we are on the map, our approach to medicine can be much more proactive, informed, and empowered. So I start out with a stage I call resilience, which is the stage when you can still reverse a lot of health problems, sometimes just by more exercise.
Right.
So there's resilience. I follow that with slowing down. Then there's adapting to various forms of disability. Then there's a very important stage I call awareness of mortality in the book, or maybe facing mortality is even better, when you have gotten some kind of a difficult diagnosis that may take you out sooner or later. Then I talk about a very important stage that I think is often sloughed over, maybe, and that's a stage I call a house of cards. It's a stage of fragility where often a hospital stay can be worse for you than simply staying home. And then there's preparing for a good death and then active dying itself.
And when you talk about these different stages, at what ages are you starting at? In your first phase, when you're talking about resilience, can you talk about an age that's around that?
Now, resilience is when you can still build up your cognitive and social and physical reserves. So that could be any time from 50 on. I know people who are in a resilience phase even though they're in their 80s because they are still exercising very vigorously and living extremely full lives. And they've actually reversed health conditions with diet, with exercise. Okay, then there's slowing down. But I'd say 50 on, but certainly 60 and above, I would say resilience.
Okay.
Slowing down. There's about a, you know, there's about a 10, depending on your overall health, there's sort of a 10 to 20 year slide factor in here. So slowing down is when you are becoming more vulnerable. You might be on multiple meds, and so therefore you want to be very, very careful about not being on too many meds. You could be 60 or 70 or 80 or 90 for that stage, but you have definitely developed at least one serious health condition, all right? Then there's adapting to disability. Most people are going to be in their 70s or 80s at this point. Awareness of mortality, facing your mortality. Again, if it's a cancer diagnosis, you could be in your 40s or 50s.
Right.
But you're more likely, again, to be in maybe your 70s or your 80s.
Yeah.
House of cards, usually the 80s. Preparing for good death. Again, it depends a lot on the diagnosis, but could be the 70s, could be the 80s, could be the 90s or above.
Yeah.
Okay? And active dying is, you know, same deal. If it's some people, unfortunately, do die young, but most of us are going to make it over the age of 70, probably have multiple different health conditions that we're contending with that get worse over time. And at each of these stages, there are signposts, and these signposts are all mentioned in the book, so you can really have a good intuitive sense of where you are on this map.
When you were doing research for your book, because you did years of research for this book, and I know you had a Facebook page with Slow Medicine. Yeah. Not only did you research by going and talking with researchers, physicians, and really vetting this, but you had quite a lot of contributors through your Slow Medicine Facebook. People who brought stories or individuals who were in the field who had a lot of experience around medicine, right? And also dealing with individuals who they observed through their own experience.
Exactly. And this was such a wonderful thing because I started, the group is called Slow Medicine, mm-hmm. and it's a confidential closed group on Facebook, but anybody who's listening is warmly invited to apply to be a member and be accepted to be a member. It's an amazing social support group because it's very positive in its tone. There's no sniping. Mm-hmm. And there's so much, a well of experience from both people who have been caregivers for spouses or for elderly family members, people who have life-threatening or serious illnesses themselves, hospice doctors and nurses, physical therapists, social workers. It's incredible depth of experience. And I feel like there's two ways that we learn, and one is through experts who may have studied something in a very scientifically correct manner. But I think the other way we learn, and I think it's often a more powerful way, is through true stories that we hear from other people. Mm-hmm. And these stories can be teaching stories. And a lot of the stories in this book actually first emerged in this Slow Medicine Facebook group. Very positive stories about ways people have handled and navigated difficult end-of-life passages well, and also cautionary tales about people who, for one reason or another, things didn't go as planned. And you can look at those stories and think, what would I have done differently? Or what would I do differently now that I know what I know now?
Now that I saw the outcome. Yeah.
Now that I saw the outcome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned in your book that there are three miracle drugs of later life. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. I think the three miracle drugs are exercise, community, and water. Dehydration is a major problem as you get older. Your body actually is a lower percentage of water than it is when you're younger. And often old people get dizzy or tired or fatigued, and it turns out they're just dehydrated or even have, you know, cognitive confusion. Yeah. It turns out they're just dehydrated. So my first bet is just lie down and have a couple glasses of water and see if it passes.
Well, and that sounds so simple.
Yeah, sorry,
but
ahead.
It sounds so simple, but that truly is a lot of individuals who are older are affected by the fact that they just don't consume enough water.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly. And the body, you know, the body, I'm sorry, I'm going to be wrong on the statistics. I'm not great at keeping these all in mind, but they are in the book. It's like when you're younger, your body is something like 85 or 95% uh-huh. water. And then when you're older, it's only 50 or 60%. And again, because your whole physiology is more vulnerable, things like your brain function or your dizziness or your balance are all more obviously affected by the dehydration.
Well, in urinary tract infection,
yeah.
urinary tract infections in older adults have a major impact, do they not?
Yeah. Same thing. And mm-hmm. they can cause cognitive confusion.
Right.
So you think someone's really having a major mental decompensation, and it's just it's a urinary tract infection.
Yeah.
But I think even more important is exercise. I think the biggest change I made personally as a result of researching this book is that I became a fanatic daily swimmer. And so I now swim a minimum of half an hour every weekday, and sometimes I'll go 45 minutes and swim a mile.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the research shows that even in your 50s and 60s, and I believe even later, adding that half an hour of vigorous exercise can reverse a lot of problems, really lower your risk for everything from dementia to a heart attack to just depression and isolation. I think it's the one miracle. And then finally, of course, it's community. None of us are going to have a completely smooth sailing through our old age and our death. And I don't think we need so much modern high-tech technology to conquer the problems of dying the way some people in Silicon Valley are trying to do. I think it's the soft technology of community, of supporting each other, of looking in on neighbors, of being willing to go pick up a prescription for a neighbor, take someone to an airport or to the grocery store. I mean, these are the things that are really going to make our more vulnerable years more meaningful, and not just for the people who are getting the help, but definitely for the people who are doing the helping, too.
You talk about reaching out to other generations, not just sticking with your own, too.
Absolutely. In that resilience, that first chapter on resilience, I really, really encourage all of us who are looking at these age groups, if not already in them, to mentor. You know, you can do the simplest things. You can take in the mail for a neighbor. You can mentor, like for me, to mentor other young writers. There are so many ways to sort of give down into the younger generations, and not only will this make you feel good right now, because there's a lot of research that shows volunteering is a buffer against depression, but on just a really stone-cold practical level, the more you build up your gratitude bank with other people, the more likely you are to feel comfortable later when you're the one that needs the prescription filled up or the ride to the doctor's office. You feel a lot more comfortable about asking someone, and they'll be much more happy to help you.
Yeah, probably so.
I mean, I'm being pretty practical here, but I think it's both a spiritual good and a practical good.
Yeah. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX, HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. Katie Butler, award-winning journalist of the New York Times bestseller, Knocking on Heaven's Door, and her new book, The Art of Dying Well, is my guest for today's show. If you have comments about today's topic or questions for Katie, you can call us at 805-781-3875 and add your voice to the conversation today. Again, that number, 805-781-3875. Katie, you talk in your book about, you know, you give a lot of practical advice, and you write about some of the best and the riskiest things, like surgeries or drugs or screenings for people over 50. Can you talk a little bit more about those things?
Sure. My sort of guiding light is look for interventions that improve your functionality and postpone disability, and really take those seriously, and be very cautious about ones that actually might damage your functionality or create disability. So on the surgery front, cataract surgery is miraculous. It actually extends people's lives because they're less likely to trip and fall. It improves your quality of life. Hip replacement, same deal, very, very important. On the other hand, back surgeries have a pretty poor track record, and open heart surgery, if you're already very fragile, can actually precipitate cognitive decline. So those are the ones that I think to really take serious on the surgery front. On the drug level, drugs like metformin to stabilize your blood sugar, blood pressure meds, those are really excellent things that will, again, postpone disability, make it less likely you're going to get sick. They've been really proven. On the other hand, there's an extremely risky class of drugs called anticholinergics. These include very simple over-the-counter drugs like Benadryl, for example, anti-allergy medications. And people who take a huge quantity of these, I mean, who really take them almost on a daily basis, are much more likely to develop dementia than people who stay away from them or just use them very rarely.
And they found this with scientific research?
There is. There was a huge study at the University of Washington that tracked, I think, 3,000 people for a 10-year period and showed this correlation between heavy use of these drugs and early dementia diagnoses.
And a lot of people have gotten into using, for instance, something like Benadryl for sleep aids.
Yeah. And again, one of the things I say in the book is start with what requires the most of you and the least of medicine. Mm-hmm. So in a case like you're having trouble sleeping, a lot of older people have trouble sleeping.
Right.
You want to look at every 5-cent solution that might improve things incrementally. So get a new bed. Get a new mattress. Have sleep-tight blinds that really cut out light. Don't look at computers after dinner in the evening. Take a hot bath. All of these home remedies, these sort of grandmother approaches to these problems, you might be a lot better off doing a lot of those. Even though they're time-consuming, it takes time to get them in place, that might be a lot better for you than searching for some silver bullet pharmaceutical remedy.
Yeah. You talk about the 5 B's of late life independence. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I just call these balance, brain, brawn, beans, and buddies. Okay, we already talked about buddies. That's the community part of things.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the things that are really at risk as you age. Your balance, because if you fall, you might very well break a bone, and that will lead to a downward spiral. We want to maintain our brains at all costs. We need to maintain our muscle strength for the same reasons. Your muscles wither very rapidly as you age. And beans, just to trend your diet as far as you can toward a vegetable-based diet and away from too much meat. None of us going to do perfectly on this, but even if you have a chili where it's half black beans and half turkey meat instead of all turkey meat, you're going to be ahead of the game. So these 5 B's will really reduce your risks of falling and of dementia. And these are really, I think, two of the most major risks to independence in late life and to your quality of your late life.
And, you know, I think you've also cited it, too, in your book, that research has consistently shown that over the age of 65, anybody has a higher risk of falling. And balance is an issue. Our bodies just are not as well balanced when they're older, usually, than they are when they're younger.
Yes, but you know what's astonishing to me? That my balance has improved amazingly since I started to swim so avidly.
Yeah.
I probably have much more muscle in my glutes and my legs, and that's helpful. But there may just even be something about plowing through the water and moving your head around that is actually improving my balance.
Yeah,
so
sure.
That's why I really think exercise is this miracle drug. Really miracle.
Yeah, you referred to getting involved in medicine in ologists in your book. And you know what you're describing is how we start looking at individuals as kind of a selection of parts rather than as a whole being. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. As we age, all of our separate body systems tend to work less efficiently. And the result is, given that we face such a totally fragmented healthcare system in which our primary care doctors are so overworked, often there's no one looking at the big picture. Instead, we're just seeing ourselves hop from ologist to ologist and silo to silo within the medical system. And it's so important not to get sort of hypnotized by that system and start to see yourself the same way. I think a lot of you may need these various ologists. You may need a really good cardiologist and a really good nephrologist. It's not like they have nothing to offer you, because they do. They have a lot. But if you can find yourself a geriatrician, if you started to accumulate ologists, you're going to be a lot better off. Or some people go to a concierge doctor where they have to pay extra just as a kind of a monthly fee, mm-hmm. but they're more likely to have a doctor who can take more time with them to look at the big picture, because often the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing, so the cardiologist prescribes one drug, but it actually creates a problem for the GI tract, so the gastroenterologist puts another med on top of that med, and then you get yet another med to take care of the side effect of the first two meds. And this process can be extremely destructive, and it can end up, you can end up being on multiple meds and not feeling or functioning any better than you were on no meds. So if you can, find a doctor who can really be willing to look at the whole picture.
Is it, when you talk about the medication and the polypharmacy that we get involved mm-hmm. in, it sounds like what you're referring to, too, is how it's important to get somebody to look at the combination of all the drugs together.
Absolutely.
Do you have suggestions of perhaps...
Yes, I do. Put all of your meds into one big paper bag and then schedule a medication review. This review could be done by a geriatrician or a internist, or it can often be done by a pharmacist, perhaps at Walgreens, who has experience with older people. And you want to go through every single drug and ask questions. You know, number one, why did we prescribe this? And does this original problem still exist? Is the cure worse than the disease here? Would I be better off just tolerating the original problem? Is this drug causing a side effect or a symptom that I currently have? I think I've got a new medical problem, but maybe all I have is a side effect here.
Mm-hmm.
And are these drugs interacting? Are they canceling each other out? Are they intensifying the results in an unhealthy way? So it's very important to have someone look at this entire printout. There's also a site actually online called drugs.com, and you can enter all your drugs there and see what they have to say.
And does the drugs.com actually give a review of the interaction between the two different medications?
It does. It'll sort of red flag things for you. You know, it's very helpful. And a lot of people, if you can find it, the process of weaning off these drugs can be very long, because some
right.
of them, like the Valium-type drugs, which are really not recommended for older people, you may have a year of tapering off a drug
yeah.
like that, and you need to find, at each step, you need to find non-drug remedies, alternatives, maybe lower doses. It's an involved process, and it's not something to, like, just go cold turkey and quit everything on. I have a woman in the book who was on, I think, 22 different meds, prescribed by 6 different doctors and filled at 4 different pharmacies. So absolutely nobody knew the big picture at all. And then a friend of hers got very alarmed, and she did see a geriatrician. And at the end of a year, she was off all but 5 of these meds, and on top of it, she was functioning much, much better.
Yeah.
You know, getting more exercise, you know, taking other... looking at her diet, eating better. A number of the problems were just side effect problems. And once they got slowly dismantled, she was just in much better cognitive shape and physical shape.
When you're talking about exercise for people, you're not talking about somebody slapping on latex and going out and, you know,
no.
doing, you know, a Jane Fonda workout tape that they may have done in the 60s or 70s. So,
yeah, and in fact, you have to be really careful. I'm having to be very patient right now, because I actually did get cataract surgery and I couldn't swim for 2 weeks. And now I'm back in the pool, but I was swimming nearly a mile a day, and now I'm swimming about a half a mile. And
right.
If I up it too fast, I find myself really exhausted. You have to be incredibly patient with yourself as you get older. And for someone who's really out of shape, getting started might be as simple as parking in the far end of the supermarket parking lot and walking a longer distance to the supermarket. It could be going half a block and then going a full block. I think like everything, we need to be so much more patient with ourselves than we're used to being. And slowly, slowly wins the race.
Yeah, absolutely. This is. You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your public radio from Salinas to Ventura, and streaming around the world on the web at kcbx.org. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and the voice you hear with me today is that of Katie Butler, an award-winning journalist on the New York Times bestseller "Knocking on Heaven's Door," and her new book is "The Art of Dying Well: A Practical Guide."
And I'd also really like to invite people to call in if they've come up with some good workarounds and some good successes and some good ways of dealing with situations that they weren't sure how to handle. I think there's just a huge amount of wisdom out there that we just need to communicate with each other.
Well, you came up with a lot of stuff for your book based on the feedback that people were giving you. So there is
exactly.
A lot of practical stuff. The show's live, yeah. And you can absolutely call in with your thoughts, comments, and questions. And you can do that by calling us at 805-781-3875. Again, that's 805-781-3875. And Katie, when you're talking about, you talk about a conveyor belt.
That is
kind of a medical conveyor belt that we can get on as we, you know, and you saw this with your mom and dad, right?
Yeah.
More with your dad, yeah.
The default in modern medicine, unfortunately, is to assume that everybody wants to live as long as possible, no matter how bad the quality of life. Mm-hmm. And this is an unspoken assumption, and doctors very rarely check out with their patients whether or not it's accurate in this particular case. And often it is not. So the medical conveyor belt, and of course there's a huge fear within the medical system of liability, malpractice suits, bad medical reviews, etc.
Right. So
the medical conveyor belt is to offer you the maximum treatment and really not even check in with you about whether or not that's what you want, and not to be very clear about what the risks of that are. So I think it's so important to have this map, which I lay out in the book, of where in the journey are you on. Because once you get, for example, to that house of cards stage where people become fragile, mm-hmm. If you, let's say you fall, but you didn't really hurt yourself, you just had maybe some dizziness because you hadn't drunk enough water, you're not hurt, you haven't broken any bones, you're not having symptoms of a stroke, you're not having terrible pain, but maybe a very worried son or daughter insists, or the nursing home, or the assisted living, insists that you go to the hospital, okay? You go to the hospital, you sit for hours in the ER while they take care of people with much more urgent problems. Maybe you have 3 days in the hospital, and you get more and more disoriented in the hospital because you're old, you're fragile. You're not in a familiar environment, you're not getting good food, and then you can be in a downward spiral. If you have some major reversal while you're in the hospital, you may very well end up in the intensive care unit, and there, again, you'll be in this fragmented medical system where three or four different ologists are sometimes even arguing about how to care for you. You're going downhill. Nobody wants to talk to you about the end game here. And you can end up with a death that's not only painful for you, which is a serious issue, but it also leaves a terrible emotional legacy for the people who you love and who love you, because it is very traumatic for family members to watch someone die in intensive care under circumstances that are actually extremely painful, literally painful for the patient. So I think this is why we want to talk about the people we love, about what makes our lives worth living well ahead of time. We want to sign these advanced directives and really make sure we've thought them through and we've talked about them enough so that the people who love us are comfortable and not guilt-ridden by putting down their feet and just saying, no, this is not the path my mom wanted to go on. I also think it's just very important when you are in these situations not to say, is my mom going to survive this crisis, but to say, what are the possibilities that I can be or my mom can be restored to a level of functioning that she considers worth living? Because that's a lot easier to predict than whether or not someone's going to die. You know?
Yeah. Did you find when you were talking with some of the medical care providers that sometimes asking specific questions like, will she be able to do this, 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 and this again, that are the markers for that person of what had meaning? For instance, would she be able to walk X amount of distance? Will she be able to go shopping alone? Will she be able to drive? You know, I know for my mother, she basically decided if she was going to lose her driver's license and not be able to drive, she really didn't want to live. And that was the case when she died when she was 91. She had a massive stroke and died, but she drove the day before. So,
that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's absolutely wonderful, and I think that's it. And different people draw these lines in different places. I mean, for one person, it might be, will she be able to feed herself?
Right.
Will she be able to live independently?
Mm-hmm.
Will she be able to communicate? I mean, for me, it's loving and being loved and being able to express that is very important. There's actually a wonderful example in Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, which is two men. Both of them are facing a surgery that could leave them paraplegic. One declines it. The other says, as long as I can eat chocolate ice cream, watch the games on TV, and converse with people, that's good enough a life for me. And this particular guy had the surgery, did become paraplegic, and lived quite a long, healthy, and productive life afterwards with those conditions. But we're all very different about where we draw those lines.
Right.
And we have to honor that. And also, I mean, I hate to say that we have to be such skilled questioners of our own doctors. It would be wonderful if they were better trained to lay more of this out on the table more explicitly. But until they are, I think we just have to coach ourselves on communication skills. And I do a lot of that in the new book, The Art of Dying Well, list of questions you can ask to get yourself up to speed.
Yeah. And you were talking about how kind of where medicine has gone, and I think it's trying to pull away from that, has been to assume that everyone wants to live as long as possible, regardless of what that means, what that looks like, that it's about the time that they're alive, not the quality that they're alive. If people do advanced healthcare directives, one of the things that I think is funny is it doing an advanced healthcare directive does not mean because you fill it out, it's not like a ticket, you know, on a plane, you're not buying a ticket, you're just writing in a document. But there's something scary about planning for those kinds of things for people. Do you think we're getting better at that?
You know, I do, and I want to put in a plug for palliative care and palliative care specialists, both nurses and doctors. If you're in any of these quandaries and you can get a palliative care person on your team, I think that's the number one thing to do, because they are versed in this language and they are versed in these conversations. So I think a lot is shifting within medicine. There's a lot of self-examination going on within medicine. But I think with the advanced directive, it really should be called the advanced request or something like that, because it's in essence a request. And often, frankly, they're not followed. It's much more important, I think, that you use them as a jumping off point for very serious discussions with the people who love you, so that you can leave them clear and unconflicted if they need to advocate on your behalf during, let's say, a very serious illness that is quite likely to leave with death or major disability.
You ran into that with your dad that you described in your first book. Can you kind of give a little bit of what happened with that?
Sure. So my parents thought they were completely on the up and up. They had signed advance directives. They were very clear. They weren't, make me live as long as possible, no matter what people. And they were quite articulate and direct about that. But a lot of the problems of late life and aging and disability and...
I all of a sudden kind of lost Katie here. Oh. You are listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX. We were talking with Katie Butler, who is an award-winning journalist of the New York Times and bestseller Knocking on Heaven's Door, and her new book, The Art of Dying Well. Katie has been researching since she first started with her first book about her experiences with her mom and dad when her father was diagnosed with heart problems after he had, here's Katie coming back now. Okay, when he had had a massive stroke and was in need of, hold on.
Calling in on our own show.
Hey, hello, Katie.
Sorry. Yeah, that's I don't okay. know what happened, but here I am.
Okay. You were talking about your dad.
Oh, yeah. So I don't know where it broke off, but my dad was given a pacemaker, and there was no meaningful discussion about any kind of values issues or end-of-life issues at the point that he got this device. And he was already, at this point, living a pretty miserable life, and it was only going to get more miserable with time. And so what we realized was that most advanced directives don't say anything about dementia. They don't say anything about tiny little devices like pacemakers that are internal to the body as opposed to great lumbering ventilators and intensive care units. So a lot of the problems that we face are more incremental and more subtle and nuanced than these documents really can cover. And that's why I think understanding what a good quality of life is for us is so important, and communicating that with people who love us.
You talked about the aspect of dementia, too, and I think it's now up to 1 in 6 individuals who are over the age of 80 are impacted by dementia, something like that. Having a advanced healthcare directive that addresses something around dementia in the event that it were to happen, is that something that you recommend for individuals to
Yes, actually,
include?
It's part of this book. It's part of The Art of Dying Well, and mm-hmm. I actually wrote a blog post about it for the Conversation Project, which got incredible numbers of hits, thousands and thousands of hits. So I think it's something people are really concerned about. I've laid out in very clear, simple language how I want to be treated if I have dementia, because it's not just that dementia impacts me, although of course it would impact me in a really major way, but it also has such huge emotional effect on people who love you. So in the book, I have a whole letter for my medical advocate where I specifically say things like, ask my medical team to provide comfort care only. I don't wish to be resuscitated. Ask my medical providers to allow a natural death. And then I go on from there. Do not transport me to a hospital unless I have a broken bone or uncontrolled pain. Don't intubate me. So I really make it very clear, even up to don't give me a vaccine, like a flu vaccine or a pneumonia vaccine, unless you need to do it for the protection of people around me. I think it's really a gift to the people who love us if we can save them from feeling guilt-ridden and full of doubt after we die. And I realize that if I have dementia, even if everything in this little directive is followed, it doesn't mean I'm going to die tomorrow. It
right.
could mean I don't die for another 5 years, but I don't want any barrier placed in the way of a natural death. And I've kept it pretty simple. It's a pretty simple directive.
And the, you know, a lot of what you've written in your book really is for the lay public. It is not, even though it's been the result of a lot of research done by you or done by others, and a lot of it done by others, it's written in a way that a lay person can understand. And I think that's really important, that it's
yeah, that
does,
was my
it's
goal.
Not
laden with
statistics.
My goal was to really
statistics.
Be a bridge between this very confusing subculture of modern medicine with its very technical language and just the world of ordinary life. I mean, we're all bright, we've all got common sense, and we can all be restored to a sense of clarity and empowerment about this. And that was really the goal for the book, was to give people enough of a map that they could make their own choices.
What's been the response from the medical community to this book?
Well, this is a great surprise. As I've said, I did vet the book with oncologists and palliative care doctors and geriatricians because I did want it to be in line with the best medical thinking. But every time I gave it to one of these people, the whole book, the completed book, I would be kind of holding my breath. And what I was really surprised by was how many doctors are actually very enthusiastic about it. And one particular oncologist has recommended it in big academic conferences, put it on a slide on a PowerPoint. So that was very gratifying that there's a lot of people within medicine who have been dying to say some version of what's in the book, mm-hmm. but have either not had the time or the inclination or the training as writers to really get this across to the lay public.
Yeah.
So that's been, it was a surprising and really, really gratifying and relieving response. I have yet to hear from a doctor saying this wasn't accurate or there's something wrong here. And of course, if there is, I want to correct it in the next edition, but I'm very relieved that on the whole, it seems to be really standing up. I've also been really surprised by the reactions, surprised by the huge number of people who came to bookstore readings, including in Santa Cruz, for example, mm-hmm. that we were expecting maybe 100, 150 people, and there would be 250 people there. A fierceness in the general public now, or at least a fierceness in the people who come to these readings, a real fierceness about wanting hard information so they can do things differently, stuff that can really empower them, not just a generalized spiritual book about dying, you
right.
know, but really the nuts and bolts of how am I going to navigate this.
And are they looking for navigation through this for themselves or as a caregiver for someone else?
I think both. I don't know, but I guess I tend to overgeneralize from my own experience. I mean, I'm 70 now. I've already been through the caregiving
yeah.
with my parents. I'm on to the next thing. I do hear from people who have spouses who are now going through it. So I think hopefully both books are useful to both caregivers and to aging people themselves or people who do have serious illnesses themselves. But I think the second one is more oriented towards how do we plot our own paths. But mm-hmm. we're all in it together. You know, we're going to be more and more helping our friends who are dying, helping our spouses, and setting up things so that we get good help when we need it too.
Well, I think in the book you have the trajectories of illness, which really is kind of a chart or a map of
yeah.
how illnesses can progress. And
yeah.
you've described different things like a looping decline and a
the Niagara Falls trajectory, which is the one we all want.
You know, that's the one where people
before the end.
People say, "I just want to go screaming out," or you know, you hear a lot, "I want to just die in my sleep." Then but the two most frequent ones are the looping decline and then the dwindling, you know, for those people that have dementia. So, but it's important when people look at that, if they can look at how their own illness has progressed, it can actually help, as you said, to map where they are or how they are. And to have those conversations with their physician about, okay, so what's next here? What would help me with this? You know, the idea of going into a physician's office and having someone tell you, lose weight and get exercise, what does that say? You know, I mean, that's great, but it's not probably going to be real motivating or happen. But to have something like this be charted more, I think really is more realistic.
I think it's more helpful. I think we all indulge in wishful thinking, and we live in a society that loves progress and believes in progress. And so to be in a trajectory of some sort of decline, we keep thinking it's like, well, we just took a step down, but now we're at the new normal and things are just going to continue on with the new normal. But actually, there's going to be another decline at some point. And I think what's really helpful about these trajectories is that they can help us plan for the future. Like, when are we going to need more caregiving? Mm-hmm. Are we going to need someone to drive us around? Maybe we need to hire a high school kid now before we're incapable to start doing our grocery shopping for us. Mm-hmm. And so these trajectories are a lot more helpful than just saying, doc, how much time do I have left? Because first of all, the doc is likely to be very inaccurate. It's hard to predict a timing of death precisely. But almost all these doctors have enough experience to draw you one of these little trajectories. Yeah. And you can draw them on the back of a napkin. You know, it doesn't have to be some fancy thing.
Yeah.
Some of us, I think, absorb information visually more than we do just hearing a bunch of statistics or something. And there's a simplicity to these little trajectories that I think is very helpful too.
Yeah, and I think if somebody's looking at their health and what's happened with the changes in it, and they go back and look at the last 2 years, what was I able to do 2 years ago, and then 6 months after that, and then 6 months after that, you can see whether or not anything has really shifted and changed. And that can be helpful. And rather than getting into the depression of it, it's like, okay, so how do I accommodate that?
Exactly. How do I adapt?
Right.
How do I adapt rather than how do I just fight things or put the blinders on?
Well,
it's so much more empowering. And later, it's very, very helpful if you're caring for somebody. If you're caring for someone with the dwindles, for example, or with dementia, there's some diagnoses it's very hard to get qualified for hospice, even though home care from hospice is the very best thing you could get.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got some kind of a chart like this, and you have a diary of the decline, and you can show that the decline is accelerating rapidly, you're much, much more likely to be able to get in to a hospice program.
If you were to come away from your book with maybe three or four things that are the most important things that you want to get across to people, what would those be?
Well, I would say beginning with what requires the most of you and the least of medicine, building community and building reserves before you hit a crisis. I'd say imagining a good death, what a good death means to you and what it would look like, and then kind of working back from there so that you start doing what you need to do to put that in place. Avoiding unnecessary medical risks. Knowing where you are on the trajectory between living and dying. This is one we really haven't talked about, but just simply simplifying your life, making sure that you're doing the things that matter to you and letting go of things that really don't matter, that sap your energy and use it up. I don't know. Understanding that you're working with a broken system and being kind to yourself and forgiving to those that you love as a result. We're all doing our best to navigate the landscape of aging and being sick and eventually dying. And we're also navigating, at the same time, a very, very fragmented, even if it's well-meaning, a very fragmented medical system. And we need not to blame ourselves when we don't have the so-called perfect death or a good death or someone we love that we have really tried to make it possible for them to die at home. Instead, perhaps they die in the hospital.
Yeah.
I think it's very, very important that we be kind to ourselves, to the medical people who are helping us or trying to help us, and realize how imperfect this process is going to be.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And
yeah.
And Katie, you...
There's one thing we haven't... Can I throw something
yeah,
in here?
Yeah, go ahead.
There's one thing we haven't talked about that I think is so important, and again, something I really learned in the process of writing the book, which is that you can bring an element of the sacred into a death in a hospital, even if it seems like the cards are stacked against you. I have accounts in the book of really, really beautiful hospital deaths in circumstances that were not ideal. People who bring in music or get somebody moved to a room that it has natural light and windows that can open into fresh air. People who've had very, very profound experiences of the mystery and sacredness entering the room, even in an ICU death. There are accounts of people who have weddings in the ICU.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think it's very important to kind of grab the bull by the horns, take your power, speak up, and do what you can to bring rituals into not only the process of dying itself, but into all the major transitions of later life. Like, you know, have a big party for your 70th birthday and declutter and give away things at your 70th birthday rather than getting presents. Honor these 60th wedding anniversaries. Use these occasions to give those eulogies to the people you love before they actually die. I think the more we can bring like meaning and sacredness and a sense of ritual into these universal human experiences, the richer they can be for us.
I love that. I want to thank my guest for today's show, Katie Butler, award-winning journalist of the New York Times bestseller, Knocking on Heaven's Door, and her new book, The Art of Dying Well. Next week, please join Fred Monroe as he speaks with guests Leola Dublin McMillan, Donna Hellett, and Cameron Clay in a discussion about the upcoming community workshops on building coalition entitled Preparing to Put in the Work, Intersectionality in Action, organized by Race Matters Slow County. Central Coast Voices has been sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX. I'm Chris Kington Barker. Thanks for joining us for today's show.